This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Timothy Egan, has written a book about a forest fire in 1910, a story that also concerns a major culture war of that time. Egan's book, titled The Big Burn, is now out in paperback. It tells the dramatic story of the largest forest fire in American history. That fire, in the northwestern United States, consumed 3 million acres in 2 days. It burned through eastern Washington, northern Idaho, and western Montana, creating panicked evacuations. The fire started just 5 years after President Theodore Roosevelt had created the National Forest Reserves and the National Forest Service. In 1910, with Roosevelt out of office and with President Taft being indifferent to the public lands, many members of Congress were hoping to eliminate the Forest Service budget. Among those opposed to the conservationists were the railroad and timber industries. While telling the story of the fire, Egan's book tells the political story of how the fire paradoxically saved the national forests and changed fire policy. Timothy Egan also is the author of a National Book Award-winning account of the Dust Bowl called The Worst Hard Time, and he's a columnist for the New York Times. Terry spoke with him last fall. She asked him why he wanted to tell the story of the Big Burn. At the time of their interview, fires near L.A. had burned 100,000 acres, quite small compared to the fire of 1910.
This fire was 3 million acres, so that's an area the size of Connecticut burning in a weekend. Those fires burned for 10 days. This fire was 36 hours. So a day and a half, 3 million acres, 2,000 degrees, one of these crown fires where the thing goes from treetop to treetop and sucks all the oxygen out of every cave. It's sort of a monster that takes on a life of its own. But then as a natural disaster, I think that's cool because, I mean, I guess I'm sort of drawn to natural disasters. But it has such amazing resonance. It's with us still in so many ways, both in the wrong lesson that was learned from it and in it becoming the creation myth that saved public land.
What do you know about how this massive fire got started?
Well, it was a very dry summer, and it stopped raining and snowing and sending anything down from the sky starting in April of 1910. So by the time June came around, which is pretty early in the northern Rockies, it's usually pretty cold there still, they already had some spot fires, their little lightning-caused fires. And by August, it just had the feel of death on the land, and everyone knew something was going to happen because there were all these little fires, these little lightning-caused fires, and it just blew up. A hurricane-force wind is 70 miles an hour or more. That's what caused this thing to blow up. This freak weather system came out of the eastern Washington. It's called a Palouser. And it just lifted up all these smaller fires, and it took everything to the sky, and the thing just blew up. So it was a freak convergence of a very dry summer and lightning, which caused all these smaller fires, and then this wind just lifting the thing up.
And there were little towns that had to be evacuated, and you tell some pretty vivid stories. This fire broke out in the public lands just as Teddy Roosevelt's National Forest Program was in jeopardy of getting zeroed out by Congress. So just give us a summary of like why Roosevelt created the National Forest Program in the first place.
Yes, absolutely. And the Forest Service was 5 years old when this fire happened. It happened in 1910. Roosevelt left office in 1909. His chief forester and top aide, Gifford Pinchot, was fired by Roosevelt's successor, William Taft, in 1910. So at the start of 1910, you have an orphan agency. It's lost its founder. It's lost the person who, you know, he was named Gifford Pinchot, and they were called Little Gifford Pinchots or Little GPs. They came out of Yale, and they were just infused with this idealistic image of the Great Crusade, this idea of conservation which Roosevelt and Pinchot had bequeathed to the world. So they leave this agency orphaned, and this Congress just starts picking and plucking it to death. It's death by a thousand blows. It was never popular to begin with. It was a radical idea, and then it was not popular in the West either. These young forest rangers would go out west, and they would find brothels and saloons. And I don't know if you've seen the television series Deadwood.
Exactly, that's what it seemed like reading your book.
that's what it was. You know, it was the one town of Taft, Montana, named for the aforementioned 350-pound president, had three prostitutes for every man and a higher murder rate than New York City. And so one of these rangers came out and he said he was just horrified. He gets out of Yale and he shows up in the Lolo National Forest in Montana, and he wires back to Missoula and he says, two undesirable prostitutes setting up business on national forest land. What should I do? And some smartass gets a hold of it and wires back, find two desirable ones. And so, you know, that's what they were dealing with. So they're hated by the people they're supposed to, you know, this Roosevelt idea of the little guy owning land. They don't give a rip about it. And then the Congress is killing them. They're just defunding this thing. These Gilded Age powers, it's the last sort of clash of the Gilded Age powers. And so they want this land for themselves. They're used to getting it for free. They're used to having their way with it.
And wait, and by the they, who do you mean here? It's like what, the railroads, the timber industry? Who else like wants the land?
The railroads were given more than 35 million acres for free, an area about the size of New England. You've also got the Rockefeller family, which is building the biggest and most expensive transcontinental railroad in history, right through the heart of the Bitterroot Mountains, right where the fire takes place. That's why all those people are living in those brothel-ridden saloon towns, is because they've just put this railroad together. And then you have the Guggenheims and E.H. Harriman and James J. Hill and the Weyerhaeusers, families that are largely known to us today probably only for their philanthropies. But then they were at the peak of their Gilded Age power, and they wanted this land because they were used to getting it for free. Roosevelt took it out of the general public domain and put it in the protectorate of the Forest Service, not the parks. That's different and much smaller. The Forest Service was to be the people's land. The people were going to use it. So they leave office, just to get back to your question, 1910. It's a long, dry summer. The forest rangers are reviled and hated. The agency itself is nearly defunded. And then the fire happens, and it has this dramatic effect of saving the agency and making heroes and martyrs of the people out there.
It saved the agency how?
Well, the forest rangers themselves were called Sissies and Teddy's Green Rangers, and the fire happens, and it's the first time the United States has tried to fight a wildfire. They organized an army of 10,000 people, largely immigrants, some African-American buffalo soldiers, convicts, jails are opened up, people are let out of the jails. This huge army of people are sent to the West to fight this, it's an emerging fire. It hasn't blown up yet. It's 1,000 little small fires. And they're made heroes. The press portrays them as heroic, as noble men, not the immigrants who died, but the rangers who fought this thing, who didn't have a clue what they were doing, by the way. The fire kicked their rears. They lost. But it made them heroic, and it was covered all over the U.S. The New York Times had several page one stories. The European press covered it. So suddenly, public sentiment shifted, and you saw a dramatic effect in Congress, where they refunded the agency, they doubled its budget, and they created this bill that had been lingering since Roosevelt's day to create national forest in the East. You would not have national forests in the Adirondacks in Virginia and Pennsylvania and New England without this fire.
And there were little towns that had to be evacuated, and you tell some pretty vivid stories about what the evacuations were like and the panic that ensued.
You know, I kept thinking, I hate to say this because it's kind of a stereotype, but I kept thinking of the evacuation scenes from the movie Titanic, which we've all seen, because they had a, you know, Victorian gentleman's like, women and children first, no men. But the men were shoved the women and children off the trains, and they had to have these buffalo soldiers at gunpoint with their fixed bayonets order the men off the trains. There was a last train out of Wallace, Idaho. You knew if you didn't get on that train, you were going to die. You were going to burn to death. A fellow came up to me not long ago. I was doing a reading on this book in Oregon, and he said, my grandmother got on that train, and she talked about it for the rest of her life, how she got on that last train out of town. If you didn't get on that train, you weren't going to live. And then once they got on the trains, they would get to these trestles over the valleys, and the trestles were burning. So they'd go hide in a cave. They'd back the train into one of these caves that would board through the Bitterroot Mountains. And once in the cave, the fire would find them because it was in search of oxygen. It was a beast. It was a force of its own. So I'll tell you a backstory real quickly, though. The Buffalo soldiers, who were African-American soldiers who had always sort of done the dirty work of the United States Army and segregated only by – they had white commanding officers. They had put down Indian uprisings. They had put down labor wars in this place 5 years earlier. They show up, and they're supposed to save this town, and they're greeted by the kind of racism that was typical of the day. They called them – the papers called them dusky doughboys. But the Buffalo soldiers saved at least one town of Avery, Idaho, and were instrumental in saving another, the town of Wallace.
So once the fire spread and it was covering millions of acres, how were people recruited to fight the fires?
Well, they'd done the recruiting in advance because there were all these little fires, and they wanted to get – they knew, you know, the towns were – big towns were going to start to be in danger, towns like Spokane and Missoula and possibly even Denver. So they were concerned. There were all these telegrams back to Taft, who was vacationing on – as they said, in his yachting costume was another term they used. Taft was a poor – he was so – I mean, so criticized because of his weight and everything else. But – Taft would get these telegrams saying, you know, we're going to lose the town if you don't get people out here. So he sent the army and he recruited. So they found all these immigrants. People were willing to fight fire for 25 cents an hour, which is what they paid them. So they had 10,000 people in place when the blow-up happened. And they were scattered all over the woods with shovels, doing a little bit of, you know, here and there work trying to stop these tiny fires. And then the blow-up happens and it's just all hell breaks loose.
You know, in the 21st century, it's hard enough to fight the wildfires. What was the state of forest fire fighting in 1910 when this fire broke out?
They had no clue what they were up against. They had no formal firefighting training, no manuals to consult. All these men are in place, and they're wearing, you know, khaki pants and wide-brimmed floppy hats and terrible shoes and no socks, and they're hungry. Every one of them, you see the pictures of them, they look really skinny, like war veterans. They're eating these giant pots of potatoes and beans, which are stirred up in the fire camps. And they're mostly I traced the, you know, two Italian immigrants back to their home in Italy. It was the peak of Italian immigration in the United States. So there's a lot of Italian immigrants in there. And when they died, the papers didn't even call them by name. They would say, you know, Joe Smith died and Hiram Johnson and two Italians. So they, you know, they weren't even given their proper name. But so they're in place, and they just have a shovel. That's all it is. They're just out there trying to dig a fire line, trying to scrape away a little bit of dirt so that when the fire comes up upon them, it won't advance anymore. And so they were just, you know, I hate to use this term, but they just became fuel. They just – and when they found their bodies later, most of them were not even recognizable as human forms. They were just these black encrusted – you know, burnt carbon, basically.
Some of the main characters in your story were really broken by this fire. And one of them is Gifford Pinchot, who was the founding director of the National Forest Service. And why was he a broken man after the fire?
Well, Pinchot, by the way, is just a fascinating guy. I mean, he lived from 1864, when the Civil War still raged, till 1946, when World War II was over. Was not only Roosevelt's top advisor, he was the Rahm Emanuel to Roosevelt's Barack Obama, but later became a two-term governor of Pennsylvania and an advisor to Franklin Roosevelt. It was his idea to come up with the Civilian Conservation Corps. But he was a son of privilege, a strange guy. His grandfather had clear-cut much of the state of Pennsylvania. It was a deforester.
By clear cut, you mean he cut down the trees.
Right, he cut down all the trees. That's how they got rich. So Pinchot comes from this hugely wealthy family. One of his homes was called Gray Towers in overlooking the Delaware. And there were 63 turrets and 23 fireplaces in this castle. That was one of Pinchot's three homes. He goes to Yale. He's a skull and bones. He's, he's this child of privilege. And he had this was Roosevelt's term, peculiar intimacy was the quote, with Teddy Roosevelt. They met at a young age. They used to wrestle and box, stripped down to their skivvies while, you know, kind of a D.H. Lawrence sort of thing. But Roosevelt had this wrestling mat installed in the governor's office, or the governor's mansion in Albany. And when Pinchot would come up to see him, he'd unroll the mat and they'd go at it. And Pinchot in his memoir described how one of the highlights of his life was boxing with Roosevelt and knocking him on his butt. So Roosevelt becomes president. Pinchot's his top aide, and together they try to do something audacious. They do create the idea of conservation. Now, John Muir is the third character in this, but he's off stroking his beard and making wonderful statements and living in his vineyard north of San Francisco. You can see I'm tweaking Muir quite a bit here because he always gets nothing but positive press. But Pinchot and Roosevelt are doing the heavy lifting of creating the lasting conservation movement that we have: national parks, national forests, wildlife refuges. And so, you know, when the fire happens, Pinchot realized that, like all people who can see public policy moments. They need their creative myth setting. They need their launch point. He could see that this would be the fire that would save the agency. So he immediately went on the attack, he and Roosevelt. Roosevelt was touring the West, reviving his popularity. He would soon run as a Bull Moose third-party candidate against his successor, Taft. And they used this fire as the rallying cry to save conservation. So Pinchot, though he was heartbroken by what had happened, quickly realized that this thing could be the thing that launches, that saves conservation.
So what did he do to use the fire to save conservation?
He wrote a million op-ed pieces. There were page one stories everywhere saying, you know, Pinchot was as prominent as any public official that you can think of today. One of the things I talk about was how they formed conservation. They used to go for these long walks in Rock Creek Park, or they would, Roosevelt and Pinchot would skinny dip in the Potomac. And I was thinking, you know, what would it be like if, God forbid, you know, Karl Rove and Bush were skinny dipping together in the Potomac while thinking of ways to deregulate the banks even more. You know, so and the Secret Service would hold their clothes while they would swim naked in the Potomac on a cold November day. And you know, it was like a triathlon whenever you went out with Roosevelt. And so, you know, the way they used this fire was to use their connections. They gave speeches, they wrote op-eds. Roosevelt had huge crowds because he had been away for a year. He was the most popular American in the world. The Vatican greeted him. The huge crowds greeted him all over Europe and Africa, everywhere he went. So he comes home after being away for a year, and he's mobbed. He's mobbed. So, and Pinchot wrote most of his speeches. Pinchot was his voice.
So, you know, in talking about how Pinchot tried to use the fire to save the endangered National Forest Service, you write a little bit about what he was up against. For example, one senator, a senator from Idaho, from one of the towns that burned, Wallace, Idaho.
Yes.
Weldon Heyburn. He called this fire God's will. He said it was the will of an angry God enraged by the Forest Service. Was that a widely held view?
I think it was. I actually think there were a lot of people when he said that. If you read the newspaper reaction to that, at least in the West, a lot of people said, the man speaks truth. They thought that God was sweeping away these trees, which had been or being protected by this Forest Service, sweeping away to make room for settlers. And so, yeah, I mean, but this Senator Heyburn was always after Roosevelt, as were most of Western senators. They just couldn't stand the Forest Service. They were against, you know, progressive era thoughts like clean meat inspection and minimum wage and child labor laws. But more than anything else, they were against the idea of national forests. So when the fire came along, they saw it as something that would work to their advantage, you know, the final nail in the coffin. But in fact, public sentiment was with the Forest Service, made heroes of them.
I'm wondering if there's something of a little culture war going on back in 1910 at the time of this fire.
There wasn't a little cultural war, Terry. There was a big cultural war. These people could not have been more out of place there, these Yale-trained foresters in the Deadwood United States of the West. And also, you know, they thought these two plutocrats, these two men of privilege, Roosevelt and Pinchot, were trying to foist something radical on them, even though they said they were doing it for the little guy. And that's what, you know, so you had this, the idea that the National Forests are for the little guy, a populist progressive thing, versus everyone else, meaning a lot of people trying to make a buck off the place, and then bigger people trying to say, you know, how dare you try to do this? We'd always gotten the land for free. I mean, the railroads got their 35 million acres. The Speaker of the House, Joe Cannon, said not 1 cent for scenery. So there was a huge culture war going on. And one more thing on this, and I'll be quiet, is that there, the cleave in the Republican Party that happened largely at the time of this fire, with Roosevelt then running as a Bull Moose progressive, set the stage for the Republican Party for the next 100 years. It then was the so-called, and this is not my term, that's their term, progressive party, the party that was progressive on race, on conservation. The Democrats were considered the racists, and they fought conservation. When Roosevelt left and took this wing with him, it set the stage for the party that would be Herbert Hoover, Barry Goldwater, George Bush. All of that was set by Roosevelt taking that progressive side with him.
There were lessons learned from this huge fire. But the question is, different people learn different and contradictory lessons. So
yes,
let's talk about some of the contradictory lessons that came out of this.
That's why this fire is with us still. It's not just a great tale. It's a story that's embedded into all these agencies. Now, the Forest Service was set up, as I mentioned, as this progressive era, you know, Gifford Pinchot, Teddy Roosevelt trained, idealistic young men, and they were mostly all men. But after the fire, the Forest Service became the Fire Service. And to this day, more than half of their budget is spent fighting wildfires. And that wasn't the original intent. They weren't set up to put out what is essentially part of nature. And so after the fire, about 10 years afterward, they started something called the 10 o'clock rule, which was that if a fire happened on your watch on a given day, it must be put out by 10 o'clock the next day, or you had to suffer reprimand and severe consequences. So Norman McLean, the great Montana writer who wrote A River Runs Through It and also a meditation on fire called Young Men in Fire, talked about how this had horrible consequences. He said every young ranger had 1910 on the brain for most of the 20th century. So they dedicated themselves. The fire did save America in saving the Forest Service, but thereafter their mission changed. Their mission was to put out fires. And to this day, when you see these, you know, the fire industrial complex, giant planes dropping retardants on mountains east of Los Angeles and around Colorado, and huge armies of yellow-shirted firefighters going up there with bulldozers and all of that, that's still a direct consequence of this fire, of the Forest Service deciding to put it out.
Wait, what's wrong with that?
I don't think anything's wrong or right with it, but I'll tell you what causes trouble is that by resisting nature, fire is a force of nature, you allow all this fuel to build up. And the public land agency
fuel being dry wood, dead trees.
Right. Dead trees, standing timber that nature needs to burn. There are many species of trees in the West that won't regenerate without fire. Lodgepole pine, the cones won't open. They can't have sex. They can't carry on without fire. They need fire to reproduce. So, and Pinchot knew this, but he sort of hid that. A lot of people. So, by trying to put out every fire, they'd put it in a little box. And then some of the bigger fires we had, starting in 1988 with the Yellowstone fire, continuing to this day in some of the fires that happened in Arizona a few years ago, which were catastrophic, are a result of trying to put out every fire and then having all the standing timber lying around that once a fire comes along, boom, it just becomes catastrophic. And this is not my contention. My contention is on other things, but this is universally recognized. So now you have something called the let burn policy, where they are letting fire. This dates to the Yellowstone fire of 1988, where they're letting fire back into the woods, but only here and there. The problem is that so many people have moved. Something like 20 million people now live within a few miles of a national forest. And they want, when they see fire, they're terrified. And they call their congressman, and their congressman calls the regional forest supervisor, and they say, how come you're not putting this fire out? And he says, well, it's in an area where we have to let it burn. They say, well, it's also in an area where, you know, 20 of my constituents live, and they not only vote, but they contribute. So there's political pressure there. And that's what, when you see some of these big firefighting campaigns, a lot of it is because of politics. Is somebody saying, you know, any honest firefighter will tell you somewhat ruefully that they end up fighting to save people's summer homes.
Since your new book has so much to do with the National Forest Service, I'm wondering if you've thought about, and I'm sure you have, what America would look like had there not been a National Forest Service created by Teddy Roosevelt in the early part of the 20th century.
Consider this. Roosevelt basically bequeathed us with an area about the size of France that every American owns. That's our birthright as an American citizen to own a piece of that. The parks were less than 10% of that. They get all the attention because the so-called, I hate to use this term, but people keep using it, eco-porn. You know, there's glorious shots in HD of Yosemite or Grand Tetons, but the true nature of public land is something different. It's a more rumpled area. It's a river that seldom gets visited. It's a ridgeline, you know, up in the clouds in far northeast Montana. It's a prairie grass in Nebraska. It's not the stuff that gets, you know, all the nature photographs, and that's what we own. Now, had Roosevelt not set aside this, and he did it by executive order. Congress changed the laws later, but he largely did it by executive order. I mean, he famously said when he created the first wildlife refuge, he asked his attorney general, he said, is there any law that will prevent me from declaring Pelican Island, this is in Florida, a federal bird reserve? And his attorney general told him there was no such law. And Roosevelt said, very well, then I do so declare it. And that's how the National Wildlife Refuge System was started. And when they created the National Forests, I mean, they brought in these maps and put them on the floor of the White House. And Roosevelt was just, you know, glorying in this all this land and drawing boundaries. He said, oh, have you put the Flathead Valley in there yet? I was up there once and I saw a beautiful stand of timber and these elk up in the valley. Have you put that valley in his National Forest? So imagine had we not had him. It's one of these great what-ifs of history. I grew up in eastern Washington State with a large family. We didn't have any money. We didn't have a summer home. We didn't summer anywhere. I never even heard that term as a verb until later. But we had public land, and we would go camping in the Bitterroot Mountains where this fire happened. I saw this stuff as a little kid. I saw some of the standing dead timber. We would camp in the St. Joe River, with a glorious place full of cutthroat and wildlife. And my mother always told me, we are rich because we have this. And it was ingrained into me as a little kid that I was wealthy because I owned a piece of this land. So what if it had not been set aside? I mean, you'd have this. I lived in Italy for a while, and they have a couple of national parks, but largely the nice land is owned by somebody. It's fenced off. England is the same situation. If you want to go hunt or fish or hike, you usually have to ask the lord of the manor or get permission to hike through his place. So, it's extraordinary to think how different we would have been without this endowment.
Timothy Egan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, thanks for having me.
Timothy Egan speaking with Terry Gross last fall. His latest book, The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America, is now out in paperback. Our next guest, actor Hal Holbrook, would be worth listening to even if there weren't two timely reasons to replay a conversation with him from last fall. After all, the 85-year-old actor is most famous for playing Mark Twain on stage in a one-man show that he's been performing and constantly reshaping for more than 50 years. But he's still acting, and not only as Samuel Clemens. Last year, he starred in That Evening Sun, a movie that was released this week on DVD. And also this week, he began a recurring role on the FX drama series Sons of Anarchy. Katie Sagal stars in that series, playing the widow of a biker gang leader. And Holbrook plays her estranged father, whom she visits after a long absence to drop in unannounced. She finds him watching TV, and in a state of dementia so progressed that though he recognizes her as his daughter, he has no idea that his wife has long since passed away.
Hi, Daddy. It's Gemma.
Oh, my God. My baby girl.
Yeah.
But baby girl.
It's me. It's me.
Oh. Your mama's gonna be so glad to see you. Rose. Rose. Rosie. Where are you, sweetie? You'll never guess who's here. Rosie. Oh, she's probably down at Potenza's getting her hair done.
Yeah.
Sit with me.
Okay, Dad. Yeah. Come on, Dad.
Yeah. She'll be back soon.
A sad footnote. In real life, Hal Holbrook lost his wife, Dixie Carter, to complications from cancer this spring after 26 years of marriage. Among Holbrook's most famous film roles was Deep Throat in the film All the President's Men. And in 2007, he was nominated for an Oscar for his supporting role as a lonely old man in Into the Wild. Holbrook stars as a lonely old man in That Evening Sun, which came out this week on DVD. He plays Abner Meacham, a crusty old farmer who slips away from his nursing home and returns to the farm he used to run with his late wife. Abner's son has rented the farm to his father's old enemy, and Abner wants it back. In this scene, Abner's son, played by Walton Goggins from The Shield, is basically telling Abner that his life is over and he should just give up the farm.
There's nothing out there for you anymore, Dad. Things change. Life goes on, and you gotta go on with it. There ain't any more to it than that.
Life goes on, huh?
For those who let it.
I'm an 80-year-old man with a bum hip and a weak heart. How much life do you think I got left to go on with? I'm no fool, Paul. The road ahead ain't long, and it ain't winding. It's short and straight as a goddamn poisoned arrow. But it's all I got, and I deserve to do with it as I please. And what makes me so angry is that I cut and scraped and did without so that you could go to an expensive school and learn a trade which you now seem intent on using to do me out of what has taken me a lifetime to accumulate. This must be God's finest joke.
So you're angry at me for getting an education?
I'm angry at you for not caring about the only thing left that matters to me.
That's Hal Holbrook and Walton Goggins in That Evening Sun. Hal Holbrook, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, thank you. Good to be with you, David.
I have to ask you about one sequence in That Evening Sun. It's flashbacks of you with your late wife in the movie, who's played by your real-life wife, Dixie Carter. And it's just scenes of you two, you know, embracing each other, caressing each other, looking at each other.
Dancing.
And it just seems so tender and so intimate. What was the camera actually capturing there?
They were just capturing me and Dixie. We weren't acting. We weren't acting at all. We were just enjoying. We were just loving each other's presence and face and eyes and everything. That's all. You know, I told Dixie, I mean, she said, well, it's a tiny little role, Hal. I don't know whether. And I said, believe me, darling, this moment in the film is going to be important because it's the only time you're going to see this, you know, grouchy old guy who's trying to stay alive and keep his farm and fight this character. And it's the only time you're going to see him sweet. Vulnerable. You see a whole nother side of his life that we never see at any other time, and it gives a kind of dimension to the character and the situation, I think.
Your most famous film role, I think, is a very small one, but so indelible and so iconic. I'm talking about your playing Deep Throat in the 1976 movie version of All the President's Men. You're only in a few scenes, but boy, you know, what scenes. I'm going to play one. Here you are meeting Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward, played by Robert Redford, in an underground parking garage.
Forget the myths that the media has created about the White House. The truth is, these are not very bright guys, and things got out of hand.
Hunt's come in from the cold. Supposedly, he's got a lawyer with $25,000 in a brown paper bag.
They follow the money.
What do you mean? Where?
Well, I can't tell you that.
But you could tell me that.
No, I have to do this my way. You tell me what you know, and I'll confirm. I'll keep you in the right direction if I can, but that's all. Just follow the money.
That's Hal Holbrook and Robert Redford and All the President's Men. Now, what are your memories, first of all, of filming that?
Well, I'll tell you a story that before the filming started, I was offered this role and I turned it down because it was so small. I thought, oh, this is nothing. It's nothing. And the guy's in the dark. I mean, what the heck? So I turned it down and I knew Bob Redford very well. We were good friends long in those years. We spent time together at various times. And so Bob came over to the house and he said, Hal, I want to promise you that this role will be remembered more than anything in the film. And I said, come on, you got to be, are you kidding? There's nothing to it. He said, Hal, believe me, So I said, well, okay, Bob, if you feel that way, okay, I'll do it. So he was right.
My favorite thing that I think you have done in your career is playing Mark Twain for more than 50 years on stage and once quite memorably on television. 2010 is the 100th anniversary of Twain's death. What does that say to you, that you can still find so much about Mark Twain to say about today's times? I mean, that you can have Mark Twain saying about today's times.
No. He never has ceased to astound me. And astound is the only word I can come up with. He had a bead on the corruption that went on late in his lifetime in this country. I mean, the corruption is so similar to what's going on today. You know, I'll give you an idea, see if I can remember it. It's been, I'm just trying to learn it, but it's from What Is Man and Other Essays. And he says, it's a strange panic we're in. It's like a blight that has fallen upon us, as if a mighty machine had slipped its belt and was still running and accomplishing nothing. An atmosphere of fear has spread around the land. The phrase laying off has become common. The laying off of 1,000, 2,000 and 3,000 men has become familiar. But there is a more disastrous laying off going on all over America. The discharging of one out of every three employee in every humble, small shop and industry from one end of the United States to the other.
Hal, there's two things that stun me about that. One is that just it's so fresh after so many years that it's so vital to today. The other one, I imagine how much work it takes for you as the shaper and the actor in Mark Twain Tonight to constantly go back to his material, constantly revise what you're presenting on stage, and to memorize it. How do you do all that?
I stay up late. I am driven to do it. I enjoy it. It's hard work. I have to lose a lot of sleep. I cannot give up. I cannot stop worrying about what's going on with our country and the world, because I think that this country we live in is now at a far more crucial and critical moment in its history than it has ever been in.
Hal Holbrook, I just want to thank you so much for being on Fresh Air today. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Hal Holbrook, in a conversation taped last fall. His wife, Dixie Carter, died in April. That Evening Sun, featuring their final screen appearance together, just came out on DVD. Our film critic, David Edelstein, has been trying to figure out how to classify I'm Still Here, Casey Affleck's new film about Joaquin Phoenix, his brother-in-law actor. Is it a documentary or a mockumentary? Back in the fall of 2008, Phoenix announced he was giving up acting to become a hip-hop artist. I'm Still Here presents the next few months of his transformation and his first public performances as rapper JP. Here's the review by critic DE.
You probably recall Joaquin Phoenix's flabbergasting turn on The Late Show with David Letterman in 2009. He came in looking like a Hasidic rabbi on Quaaludes. You could barely hear his mumbled one-word replies over the audience's titters. Letterman ended the interview with, "Joaquin, I'm sorry you couldn't be here tonight." But some people suspected Joaquin was very much there, and that his stated intention to abandon acting to become a rapper was a hoax, especially after they learned his change of life was the subject of a documentary by his brother-in-law, Casey Affleck. That documentary is out now. It's called I'm Still Here. It's very entertaining. And let's say off the bat that in it, neither Phoenix nor Affleck admit a thing, although they do call it a they-are-going-to-kill-us production. The odds that Phoenix's persona is an act, I put at about 99.99%. But notice I said act, not hoax. Hoaxes have no basis in reality, whereas what Phoenix is doing feels more to me like performance art. I think under all the outlandish antics, there's an emotional truth. Affleck begins with a montage of Phoenix's showbiz past, from street performances as a kid with his siblings to earlier talk show appearances, to his Golden Globe for playing Johnny Cash in Walk the Line. Then we meet Phoenix in the flesh, lurching around his house in the Hollywood Hills. Acting, he says, is like being a puppet. And when he's not before the camera, he tells Affleck, he's playing this character named Joaquin Phoenix. What follows in the ensuing weeks is a combination rebirth and degeneration. He sucks on joints and snorts cocaine. And no, I don't know if the drugs are real. He grows more and more pudgy. He humiliates members of his entourage. It's awful, but it didn't make me squirm the way, say, Borat's antics do, or Larry David on Curb Your Enthusiasm when he endlessly reshuffles his small deck of neuroses. There's a glimmer of real madness in Phoenix's method acting. He's always come off in interviews as unstable, alternately under and over defended. He abandoned showbiz once before. His brother, River, was a casualty of celebrity excess, and a few years ago, Joaquin checked into rehab. Phoenix would be a natural for one of those actorish existential breakdowns, the ones that turn on the old conundrum, where does my mask end and my true self begin? Having said all that, I don't believe that I'm Still Here is a straight documentary. Bits with Ben Stiller courting Phoenix for a role and Edward James Olmos giving new-age fatherly advice are like hilarious improvs. Even better are scenes with hip-hop mogul Sean P. Diddy Combs, whom Phoenix wants to produce his raps. At the recent Venice Film Festival, Affleck half admitted that Combs was aware of his role in the story, to crush Phoenix's dreams of rap stardom. But how he does that is inspired.
Do you have money to do this?
Like how much? I mean, I have a little studio, do you know? Like in my garage, got Pro Tools set up.
See, that's a problem. When people try to do things, they don't do it the way they do it for their own industries. When you go make a movie, you got money to make a movie, right?
What I want it to be is like a place of true exploration.
Can you do that in acting?
Well, I do. That's the thing is that as an actor, you're shielded. It's a different, you know, I mean, you know this, Christ.
No, that's not a different thing.
But you
lights, right?
See
lights.
Shit. Yes, how much?
Craft services.
Yeah, it costs a lot.
Trailers.
Yeah.
Makeup, hair, DP.
Good point.
Gaffers.
I get it.
Same thing. Studio, engineer.
I got it.
Me.
Well.
Me.
Yeah, you.
The speakers.
I get it.
Do you have any money?
Well, how much do you need?
How much you got?
Regardless of how much money Phoenix has, his raps are appalling. Although kudos to him for rhyming Joaquin and tear out my spleen. I'm Still Here builds to that notorious Letterman appearance, which we watch and then watch Phoenix watch. He looks stricken. I'm guessing part of him is stricken, wondering, as exhibitionists often do, after the fact, if he has permanently wrecked his career. Small wonder. What will be the consequences of his self-immolation? It's best to think of I'm Still Here not as a mockumentary in the style of Christopher Guest, but an experiment, something Phoenix and Affleck's friend, filmmaker Gus Van Sant, might do. The film closes with a long, entrancing, Van Sant-like shot of Phoenix in Panama, walking upriver in search of what? Affleck clearly didn't know how to end the story. And it still hasn't ended. Let's see what happens after the movie opens.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.